the cost of the war is paid by the poor. And that means cuts in domestic spendings to go and pay for missiles to bomb innocent citizens abroad.
There's so much hubris in this in administration right now. There's so much arrogance. They seem to think that they can, you know, they can do this so quickly and with it, you know, this so-called, you know, minimum, you know, casualties in different places.
In the 1980s, we could cross the border and pay for our whole trip with this money. All our accommodation, our food, everything. But now this money won't even buy a single Coca-Cola.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Monday, April 28, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. A group of Iraqi civilians are planning to bring the U.S. up on charges of war crimes. According to the Washington Times, Iraqis are preparing a complaint to present in court in Belgium, accusing Allied Commander General Tommy Franks and other U.S. military officials of war crimes in Iraq, according to the attorney representing the plaintiffs. Jan Furman, a Brussels-based lawyer representing the group, says the complaint will state that coalition forces are responsible for the indiscriminate killing of Iraqi civilians, the bombing of a marketplace in Baghdad, the shooting of an ambulance, and failure to prevent the mass looting of hospitals. He is representing about 10 Iraqis who say they were victims of or eyewitnesses to atrocities committed during so-called Operation Iraqi Freedom. The British Times is reporting that a triumphant United States plans to press home its advantage this week by seeking Security Council support for a resolution that effectively would sideline the UN in Iraq and transfer the country's oil wealth to a new Iraqi government. After a power struggle between the State Department and Pentagon, the White House has endorsed the Pentagon's hardline view that Washington should push the UN to endorse an interim Iraqi authority and lift sanctions on the country. The goal is to set up the new Iraqi administration at a conference in Baghdad by June 3rd, when the present phase of the UN's oil for food program expires. The interim authority would then take control of Iraq's oil sales under the supervision of the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund. Meanwhile, speaking today to American troops at the U.S. Central Command Base in Doha, Qatar, War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld praised the soldiers for their sacrifices over the past several months in bringing down the Saddam Hussein regime.
I know you've worked long hours under considerable pressure, often in difficult circumstances, and I know it's not been easy. But think what's been accomplished. You've helped rescue a nation and liberate a people. You have driven a repressive regime from power, ended a threat to free people everywhere. You've protected a country, our country, from a gathering danger, and given the Iraqi people a chance to build a free nation and to live normal lives.
Last week, Rumsfeld said that humanitarian organizations were now leaving Iraq because no humanitarian crisis exists in Iraq. To get an update of conditions on the ground, Peace Watch spoke today to Doctors Without Borders, a non-governmental organization with a team stationed in Baghdad. Dr. Maria Louise Linderer, an anesthetist from Germany, has been in Baghdad for a little over 10 days. Linderer said chaos is ruling Baghdad. Nothing is functioning, she says. Many hospitals are not working very well. Many of the patients are stored in the entry hall. Sometimes in the entrance hall, they are coming all together, patients with fresh wounds and patients with infected wounds who came weeks ago. It's a complete disaster, she says.
It's completely crazy. Yeah, you go to this emergency room, you hear the crying from the patient. You see the wounded patient, and you are blocked to do anything for them. I cannot stand this as a doctor.
Are the U.S. troops blocking you from administering the medical care that the patients need?
Yeah, this is true. There is an order that all the NGOs could not work in the moment. There will be a meeting on Wednesday with the Ministry of Health and some other people from the United States, and then they will make some proposals how to get along with this system. But in the moment, yeah, there is a need, and we cannot care for this need.
So I want to be very clear about this, Dr. Linderer. You're saying that there's been some sort of order issued by the U.S. military there that you and other NGOs cannot actually administer medical care to the people?
Yeah, this is true. In the moment, there's the order that not any hospital should work together with NGOs. Until this meeting on Wednesday, there are new plans to do then.
Dr. Maria Louise Linderer, anesthetist and general practitioner with Doctors Without Borders. Peace Watch also spoke with Dr. Kevin Phelan of Doctors Without Borders, who is the press agent in Baghdad, to respond to the assertion by Donald Rumsfeld that there is no humanitarian crisis in Baghdad.
Right now, there is a political crisis and administrative chaos. MSF has not detected epidemics or mass displacements or famine, but the health system is collapsed, and the people of Baghdad have a much more sophisticated system, and it is the responsibility of the occupying power to meet the urgent basic needs of the population, and that's not being done now in the hospitals and in the health centers, in the health sector. I think the administrative chaos in the hospitals has made it difficult for people to know who is in charge. And so that administrative chaos has made it difficult. It's amazing that they didn't foresee the need for administrative systems to be put in place in this, the most well-planned war that I can remember. Imagine a city with the combined population of Houston and Dallas going without public service for so long, or with sporadic public service for so long.
So what does the situation look like there in the hospitals?
Well, it varies really from hospital to hospital, from one extreme of completely gutted, a few of those occur, to ones that are struggling to cope pretty well. They protected their hospitals, etc. But in general, it really does seem like just a collapse in the administration.
So can you just sort of give us a description of what the situation is like?
Well, the lobby at Al-Wasiti Hospital is filled with patients during the day coming in. And that's the lobby.
And are they being treated?
To the best of the ability of overworked doctors who've not received any payment in conditions that are rather unsanitary.
What do you mean unsanitary?
Oh, my goodness. Imagine being treated in the lobby of anywhere with 20, 30 other people, sick people around you as well.
Well, is the water back on in Baghdad? Is the electricity back functioning in some...
Again, it's sporadic and limited. We were at a hospital yesterday, a 13-floor hospital that had no electricity during the middle of the day. So it's being provided by certain generators. It's being provided by generators that the hospital had installed to prepare for this crisis.
So,
but if those generators go out, there's no electricity for a hospital. I mean, I think anybody could imagine the consequences there.
I'm not sure that our listeners can just automatically translate in their minds exactly what that means. If you were there in Baghdad and you're in need of medical care and there's no electricity, what impact that has on your situation?
Yes, I think in terms of the ambulance service, one of our doctors the other day people keep coming into our home here in Baghdad and ask us which hospitals are open, where can you get care. One man came in, his brother was suffering from an acute infection after a surgery from a few weeks ago, and there was no way for him to call an ambulance or to know which hospitals were open. So it's an impossible situation for such a large city. These are matters that the Americans should have planned for if public health was more of their concern.
So were you able to share information with him about other hospitals, or is that information that nobody really has access to? Has the communication system broken down to the degree where even you couldn't tell him.
No, we went around to some of the hospitals that we had assessed and, you know, basically took him to one of the hospitals. But that's no solution at all for such a massive city.
Mm-hmm.
We've done our assessments, but we haven't seen any epidemics. We haven't seen any mass displacements of people. We haven't seen any famine situation. And these are things that we deal with on a daily basis in places like Democratic Republic of Congo and Chad and the South Sudan.
So in
which, you know, they're in Chad, there are tens of thousands of people displaced from fighting there.
So this is not a humanitarian crisis, but it is,
it's more a political crisis with very substantial needs for people that were used to a level of care, and now that system of care has absolutely collapsed.
Is your group going to be leaving Baghdad as a result of this collapse in the system?
We will stay here to monitor the situation and see where we can help fill in the gaps that aren't being attended to.
Kevin Phelan, a spokesperson for Doctors Without Borders, speaking with us from Baghdad, Iraq. As the combat phase of the U.S.-led invasion into Iraq begins to wind down, we turn to the crisis in North Korea. On Friday, we spoke to journalist Tim Sharrock regarding relations between the U.S. and Korea. The meetings last week ended with very little development. In part two, Sharrock advises the role of South Korea in the developing talks with the U.S.
There was a lot of criticism within South Korea of the fact that South Korea was not part of these talks, but, I mean, they've been trying desperately to get the U.S. to talk to North Korea again, and President Noam Yoo-hun, who's going to be in Washington meeting President Bush, he's said over and over again he's against an attack on North Korea. He does not want this resolved militarily, and relations between South Korea and the United States are very fragile right now because there's a lot of anger. The anger in South Korea toward the U.S. policy and the Bush administration is unbelievable. It's I wouldn't characterize it as anti-American. It's anti-Bush. It's anti-U.S. foreign policy. You know, people appreciate Americans there, but they, you know, this has been going on for a long time. This dates back to, you know, before this crisis when I was there in 2001. Before the events of 9/11, I was stunned by the level of hostility toward the Bush administration then, because, you know, as we got to remember, you know, the Clinton administration had some very serious negotiations with North Korea about you know, finally reaching some kind of peace agreement, and they were going to have an agreement to have North Korea would end its missile production and exports of missiles, and Bush administration just walked away from it. They said, well, you know, we don't trust North Korea, and we're not going to continue this. And they completely rejected the Clinton path. And then when President Kim Dae-jung came here of South Korea, and he wanted support for his so-called sunshine policy, which is engagement, economic ties, cooperation with North Korea, Bush completely dissed him and embarrassed him in public by saying, you know, he doesn't trust Kim Jong-il, North Korea, and they're not going to continue this kind of policy.
Are you familiar with the project for the New American Century? And how does that factor
not
in?
Not on Korea so much.
Okay, it doesn't factor in?
Well, I mean, a lot of those, you know, people like, you know, Pearl's been, Pearl of the, of who works closely with him has been, you know, has talked about, you know, he's very hawkish toward North Korea. But I think they haven't played too much of a role in this.
Finally, I want to ask again, so what are the chances that we may end up at war with North Korea?
You know, that's really hard to answer because there's so many factors here. And I think the Bush administration clearly knows, you know, the dangers and how terrible and the serious implications of military conflict there. But there's so much hubris in this in administration right now. There's so much arrogance. They seem to think that they can, you know, they can do this so quickly and with it, you know, this so-called, you know, minimum, you know, casualties in different places, you know, these precision, these guided missiles, these words they use to make everyone forget about, you know, the people that are killed and maimed. They seem to have the idea that they can do this, and that's what concerns me. I think that it's very important for people in the peace movement now to really learn about Korea, get the facts, what's happened there, you know, what the history of this conflict is, you know, what's happened since the Korean War, how South Koreans feel about the situation. When people talk about a war with North Korea, it's not going to be a war just with North Korea, between the U.S. and North Korea, because a lot of people in the South are very angry at the United States, and there's a feeling of nationalism there that, despite their huge differences over, you know, how to run a society, democracy, a lot of people would resist an American war there. So, you know, I think that the danger is high. I don't think they're going to do anything, you know, soon, but I think they've got to change the policy and just take North Korea seriously and say, okay, we will negotiate a peace agreement with you. I think the problem is Republicans and people who've been very opposed to the agreements that Clinton made, you know, just simply hope that North Korea would collapse of its own weight and go away. And they actually did not meet the U.S. terms of the agreement that Clinton signed. And the North Koreans felt betrayed. So I think we have a responsibility here, too, to say, okay, we will try to meet those agreements and do something to help the Koreas reach a peaceful unification, whatever they choose, however they choose it, and move toward reconciliation. Mm-hmm. And the way to do that, you know, lifting this state of war would help North Korea develop economically, allow South Korea to help North Korea develop economically and other countries in the region. And I think that's the way out.
What has ratcheted the discussion up to this level of threats? Is it Iraq or the U.S.? Is it an attempt to shut down the oil pipelines?
Well, you know, it's interesting. During the war in Iraq, the North Koreans were very quiet. You know, they didn't say much. And then, you know, right as the war was ending, they put out a statement saying, you know, backing off from their previous insistence that there be strict bilateral talks. And they said, you know, they'd accept other forms of discussion with the U.S. And that was seen as a giant leap. And, of course, the Bush people immediately jumped on that as, you know, that's what the war with Iraq was all about, you know, showing these countries. And then the next day, the North Koreans put out these statements that seemed to be conflicting, and wasn't quite sure. No one was quite sure what they meant, whether they were reprocessing or not. But they made it clear that they were either close to or planning to build nuclear weapons to defend themselves. And then apparently the other day they said they had these weapons. So, you know, I actually don't think the situation has actually changed that much. They've just said, okay, we've got the weapons, we've been able to build two, and to stop us from going forward, we need to have an agreement. We need to have negotiations. We need to move forward on, you know, we want to have a non-aggression treaty. That's what they said again. So I think it's still a question of whether the United States is willing to negotiate with this regime, and I think that's the question. My analysis in terms of comparing Iraq and North Korea is that I see the U.S. as having its own long-range goals in the Middle East, of sort of remaking the Middle East and sort of its image to politically and economically. But, you know, East Asia was remade, so to speak, during the Cold War, through the alliance with Japan, the relationships with other countries there, and economically, of course, it's developed very rapidly. And so, you know, North Korea is kind of a problem in the middle of a reorganized region. I think in all the countries in that area want to have this resolved peacefully because, you know, that's a very dynamic part of the world in terms of their economy. I'm sort of unhappy with the direction of American policy, but I don't think we should think a war is imminent.
Independent journalist Tim Sharrock has written about U.S. relations with Korea for over 20 years. This afternoon, marchers completed the final 9-mile leg of a 3-day peace and justice walk from Baltimore, Maryland to Washington, D.C. Today, they arrived at the White House to call attention to the victims of war and the cuts to funding for social programs. Joining the march for day 2's 16-mile stretch, Pacifica Peace Watch correspondent Sarah Turner reports.
All the way to Washington, I'm gonna let it shine. I said all the way to Washington, I'm gonna let it shine. I said all the way to Washington, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine.
On Saturday, over 50 pro-peace activists embarked on a 3-day, 38-mile journey taking them from Baltimore to Washington, D.C. Virginia Rodina of the Baltimore Anti-War Coordinating Committee illustrates the point of their march.
Our theme is the cost of the war is paid by the poor, and that means cuts in domestic spendings to go and pay for missiles to bomb innocent citizens abroad.
And with the Bush administration's insistence on continuing to push for tax cuts for the richest Americans, the marchers are worried that poor and working class people will be forced to foot the bill. Joshua Brown, march organizer, felt their message needed to reach people who are not accustomed to protest.
I think that it's important for Americans to understand why they should be opposed to George Bush and his foreign policy and the policy of preemptive war, because we are paying for it every day in the losses to our programs, welfare, Medicaid, Medicare, WIC, women, infants, and children are paying for these weapons that are being used to kill innocent Iraqis.
The marchers endured several incidents of motorists shouting profanities, as well as frequent bursts of honking from supporters. And then there were those SUV drivers with more pressing concerns.
What do you think about what's going on? We're marching against war from Baltimore to D.C.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah?
Do you know how to get to the mall?
Sustain member Penny Howard was marching to express solidarity with those struggling to survive the violence of war and occupation in Iraq, Palestine, and throughout the Middle East.
The occupation that the Iraqi people are starting to experience is going to end up looking a lot like the occupation that the Palestinians experience. And in fact, they're supported by exactly the same people, which is the United States government and military complex.
In Betty Robinson's judgment, the march was immensely successful in its goal to educate the public that the cost of war is paid by the poor. A Baltimore resident and community organizer, Robinson shared the conviction of those around her to continue organizing and educating for peace.
I don't think the war is over. I mean, first of all, we're still occupying Iraq, and there's still a question of whether we're really going to turn Iraq back to the Iraqi people now that we've, quote-unquote, liberated them. What are we going to do with their oil? How are we going to be treating people over there? And I think there's a bigger context.
We are rising up, and our spirits are afire. Sisters and brothers, spread your wings and fly higher.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Sarah Turner, reporting from Washington, D.C.
A Pew Research Center survey of 1,254 adults in February found that 66% of Americans backed military action in Iraq, but that 44% of blacks favored war, the lowest level of any group surveyed. That's according to an article in today's Washington Times newspaper. The survey found that about 73% of whites and 67% of Hispanics supported the war. An Atlanta Journal-Constitution Zogby America poll of 1,200 likely voters in February found that only 25% support the war among blacks, about 70% of men, and 50% of women said they supported the war. And as recently as this month, about 49% of blacks said they backed the war, according to a Washington Post ABC News telephone survey of 1,030 randomly selected adults conducted April 2nd through the 6th. The same poll found that about 81% of whites supported the war. The Washington Times quotes David Bositis, senior political analyst at the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies, as saying that blacks' opposition to the war has grown out of their distrust for the Bush administration. Bositis said that because 9% of blacks voted for Mr. Bush in 2000, a lower percentage than any Republican since Barry Goldwater, he is not likely to get black support for something like this. However, Ron Walters, director of the African American Leadership Institute and a professor of government and politics at the University of Maryland, says blacks have objected to war in general, at least since Vietnam. Black Voices for Peace, a grassroots organization born out of opposition to the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, hosted a rally and spiritual gathering on Friday at the Plymouth Congregational Church in the nation's capital. Activists and artists called for peace and justice abroad and at home, where many fear civil liberties are under direct assault. More than 1,500 people packed the church in a multicultural mobilization against the war. The Reverend Walter Fontroy of the New Bethel Baptist Church called for the creation of a Peace and Justice Council and a massive national campaign to vote Bush out of office next year.
We've come through 2 years of intense struggle with Black Voices for Peace to end the barbarism of war and the decadence of racism and the scourge of poverty. Dr. King taught us something that I shall never forget, and that is that when we are engaged in struggles for peace and justice such as we have been about in the last 2 years, we may not always win, but we never lose. And on basis of that, I have come to suggest where we ought to go from here. An anonymous writer wrote, "I've dreamed many dreams that vanished away with the dawn, but I've realized enough of my cherished dreams to make me want to dream on. I've sown many seeds that fell by the way for the birds to feed upon, but I've held enough golden sheaves in my hands to make me want to sow on. I've trusted many a friend who failed me and left me to weep alone, but I've found enough of my friend's true blue to make me want to trust on. I have drained in these last 2 years the cup of disappointment and pain and walked many miles without song, but I've sipped enough nectar from the roses of life to make me want to fight on." And so we've decided to fight on. We have come with a proposal that we form a Peace with Justice Council of all of the activists across this nation who've stood with us to prevent the war on Iraq. And that we, since this is a public policy matter, organize to work together as never before to register and prepare to vote next year. Millions of our people. Because these are matters of public policy. Whether we will have Medicaid for the sick poor, whether we're going to have housing for the homeless, or war on Iran, or war on Syria or Libya, or across Africa, matters of public policy. And we believe that beginning tomorrow, and remembering the young men at Greensboro, North Carolina, in 1960, and Cheney, Schwerner, and Goodman in Meridian, Mississippi, we have decided we are going to call upon our young people to lead us. And they have resolved that they are going to give me their names and solicit from among the hip-hop generation the names and addresses of everyone who is concerned, as we are, to end the barbarism of war, the decadence of racism, and the scourge of poverty. And against the background of what I've learned over these years, I'm going to be able to send them the names of five people who live on the block where they live, who are eligible to vote but not registered. And they have resolved that if everybody does a little, nobody will have to do a lot. And if you see hip-hoppers all over this nation at their concerts enlisting people who will give me their names and addresses, in order they can get their five and do two things with them between now and January 15th. Get them registered as a birthday present to Martin Luther King Jr. on January the 15th, 2004. And then take them to the polls with them. Each one take five. In November of 2004, and change the course of world history with our marching feet. Now, if every one of our organizations follows their example, in the African-American community, if the Elks and the Masons and the AKs and the Deltas and the Kappas and the Qs, if those in our colleges and universities who next week in the South are going to give me their names and addresses and go home and this summer register five apiece, if we all do that, we will bring justice to this nation and around the world in the years to come. And so I finally say to you in that regard, don't be discouraged. We shall overcome. If we don't overcome, then truth is a lie. And justice is injustice. And right is wrong. But we shall overcome because truth is truth. And you've heard it here tonight. And justice is justice. And right is right. And right the day must win. Let's go forth to win at the ballot box.
The Reverend Walter Fauntroy of the New Bethel Baptist Church. Thanks to Chris Strom from the IMC at D.C. and Reem Kathuda, Peace Watch producer for WPFW Pacifica Station in Washington, D.C. for that segment. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.